Hey, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of Plucking Up. We are talking about a light, fluffy, fun subject like we always do on Plucking Up. JK, we're talking about racial injustices and how it plagues America and how as organizations and individuals, we can take action in different ways with kind of different focuses. Whether that means providing more equitable resources, access to opportunities, economic mobility, or even just educating ourselves to be more aware of the racism that is all around us. Our guest today is actually teaching us about a really important aspect of racial justice, which is the concept of emotional justice. Esther Arma is the founder of Arma Institute of Emotional Justice. Esther is also an award-winning journalist and playwright. So much of her work focuses on educating white and black people about the emotional work that is needed to end systemic equality. I love her approach of humanizing, of using the science of psychology and communication to be more effective in this work. In our conversation, Esther talks about her journey as a journalist and her current mission to use this emotional justice platform and framework for providing racial healing and ending systemic racism in our society. There is a lot to learn and digest in this episode, and I'm really grateful for Esther, her presence, and her teaching, and I can't wait for you to hear it too. Esther, thank you so much for being here on the show. I'm so excited to learn more about your journey and work and really excited for our community to hear from you today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm just excited to be here and to have this conversation.
Will you start off by telling us where you come from and kind of going as far back into the Esther story as you can go? Tell us a little bit about how you grew up, your family of origin, maybe any of those kind of early life experiences that now in hindsight you can kind of see were perhaps threads of your story.
Starts with three words. A global black chick. That's okay. How I describe myself.
TM.
TM. Not TM'd, but maybe I should TM that. Another thing I should TM. Yeah. So I self-describe as a global black chick. And so by that, I mean, I was born in London, in the UK, and then went to school there and started my journalism career there. Then I lived in New York for almost 10 years and was working as a journalist and a writer. Also became a playwright while I was in New York. And then I moved to Accra in Ghana in West Africa. And so my family is Ghanaian, but the point of that global black chick description is it really shapes the way that I look at the world. And so my blackness is shaped by the UK. It's shaped by an African-American experience specifically, and also a Ghanaian one that is really ancestral and tribe and culture. And those three things together really inform and shape my work. That's really the easiest way to describe me because it's such a specific lens through which I look at the world, the way that I walk, and that shapes my approach to all the work that I do.
Yeah. Talk about three like cultural hubs to influence. I mean, such a unique triangulation of cultures and experiences. Will you tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up in London?
So London was interesting. So I was raised in a place called Kilburn. And so Kilburn was known as Little Dublin. That's because it was really a place that was full of Irish people. And so historically, in the UK, the discrimination was often against black people, Irish people. There would literally be signs that said, no blacks, no Irish, no dogs.
Wow.
That was the kind of historical reality of the UK and discrimination. So there's a lot of connection in those spaces. But the other big community in London is from the Caribbean, really specifically Jamaica and Trinidad. But those are really two big communities, and they really shaped me, my dear friends, my closest friends, all jam rockers, as I call them. And so they were real influences in how I moved through the world. And that also, I had this combination of a household, my we're of tribes. So my mother is Ashanti and my father, God rest his soul, is Nzuma. So at home, it's very cultural. We're eating fufu and soup and jollof rice and chicken. It's very cultural. And then I would step into friends' houses and it was Jamaican rice and peas and jerk chicken. And if it was Trini, roti. And so there were these kind of cultural touchstones that shaped how I moved through the world. But also the Indian community is very, very strong in London. And I navigated this place of what I call between pride and shame. So I come from a home where there was a lot of pride in being African and Ghanaian. But I went to school where to be African was almost to be a walking insult. And so I would claim a Caribbean heritage because my physical self could kind of pass between, and you couldn't really tell by the accent. And then I could do a pretty badass Jamaican accent. It's horrible now, but then I'm claiming it. No one's taking it away. I'm claiming it.
Wait, wasn't that is yours to have.
It is mine to have, claiming it. Only God knows the truth of what I was trying to navigate. And so I always learned. So I learned young about navigating blacknesses, that there wasn't one. There were these different realities. And then I had, you know, then I had other friends. And one of my best friends in school was Scottish. And I remember going to her home and just sitting down to eat and just not understanding this concept of white bread and tea with food. Like, why do they do this? Where do they do that at? And so food was such an interesting entry point to how I experienced, you know, different friends. But that was very much how London shaped me. And then specifically the racism of the UK, which is what I call quietly lethal. And there's too often this comparison between the UK and the US. And it's always like in the US, it's so much worse. And I would say having lived in both places, they're equally bad, but they're just different in how they're bad. But the UK racism is quietly lethal. It really is.
Okay, will you tell us more about that? Is that how, why? What's the dynamic? How is it different? And why do you define it as quietly lethal?
So I think that the easiest example is around enslavement. So in the UK, there is a massive celebration of William Wilberforce, who was credited with abolishing enslavement. And when I say massive, like I remember when it was the 200-year anniversary, and they were programming. I was with a journalist with the BBC at the time. There was programming all across the airwaves, TV, radio, print, you name it. So there's this massive celebration of the abolition of enslavement. But the UK doesn't acknowledge that it was a hub of slavery. And so this dichotomy of you literally honor the anniversary of abolition, but refuse to acknowledge that this was a place of where enslavement actually happened. And when it's brought up in any way, whether it's by Black British historians or activists, the level of assault that is rained down on people is extraordinary. And so the denial of enslavement right next to the celebration of the abolition of it is the best example of Britain's particularly schizophrenic relationship with racism. But then the impact that has on you moving through the world and your lived experience is really a thing to navigate.
Okay, so comparing that to your experience of living in the US, which part is different? Is it your experience of the lack of celebration of abolition or more so in the denial of its existence in the first place? Like, how would you contrast that dichotomy to your experience in the United States?
So in the US, I think there's a more overt recognition that America was built on the foundation of slavery. Okay. Now there's in the US, there's the argument, you know, so you have certain elements of the Republicans who are arguing, but you know, slavery was good. People ate, they had accommodation, you know, that bullshit that people say about enslavement. But they don't deny that slavery existed. They just want, it's just contested territory. In the UK, it's just straight up denial. And then denial is vicious. And how it comes for you. There's a narrative all across the media about how it's written about, how it's not written about. And it has a real, the impact on that, on certainly I experienced and my community experienced and folks that I moved with on the emotional health of Black people is really something. Also, the nature of resistance is different in the two places. And so there is a rich history of resistance, both in the UK and in the US. Mm-hmm. The resistance in the US is more out loud and has a different history. Mm. Because Britishness is just by nature this kind of weird stiff upper lip, you know, what's mm-hmm. that phrase? Chin up and carry on. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Just this mm-hmm. this reverence for staying stoic and not mm-hmm. really showing emotion. And mm-hmm. In the US, it's just more overt. Anger is anger. Mm-hmm. Injustice is injustice. People can mm-hmm. argue about the injustice, but it's going to be stated. And then mm-hmm. I think in the UK, the nature of the resistance, it feels quieter. So those are the differences that I would say.
It's tricky. I imagine it would be, at least in the U.S., you know, a little bit, and I laugh, but I think it's for the worse, that especially over the last several years, we're only moving towards more overtness and more unapologeticness. But there is more of a sense of, at least you know what you're getting, whereas I feel like the way that you're describing the U.K. just feels mentally very tricky of, like, trying to navigate that. I mean, especially as a kid or a teenager, that dichotomy just sounds tricky.
Much more than tricky. It's, you know, traumatizing. It's devastating.
Well, yes.
It impacts, you know, emotional health. And then it's really kid, teen, adult, all three, you know, areas. And there's definite, you know, there's this really interesting thing. So, for example, COVID happened. I gave the example of slavery. Mm-hmm. COVID happened. Globally, we saw this disproportionate impact on Black and brown people, numbers of diagnoses, numbers of deaths. So that was true in the UK as well. So the numbers told the story of how health inequity and racism, housing, all of those things impact Black and brown people, higher numbers of diagnoses, higher numbers of deaths. Then they do an entire report that denies that there's any such thing as institutional racism. That's very typically British. The evidence of racism is right in front of you, and then you gather all these people to create an entire report that says the thing that you just experienced didn't happen and it's not real.
Yeah. Will you tell us a little bit about, okay, so growing up in this very, I mean, globally multicultural context, but even like on a local level, just with your, you know, your community and in your school and in your home, tell us a little bit about your kind of academic or vocational journey. Tell us about who you were as a student. And then once you graduated from secondary or high school, where did your path lead you?
So I was a languages chick. Okay. Loved to speak a language. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm a storyteller by trade, more than journalist or something, but I'm definitely a storyteller. Mm. And that part of that comes from being raised in a home where around the dinner table, the children had to be silent and only my parents spoke. And my parents spoke in our traditional, the language of Chui, which is the Ghanaian language that they spoke at home. And we sitting around the table were not allowed to speak. So it makes you a really keen, you know, listener. So I would listen to accents and I would listen to language. And I loved languages. So I was always going to be, wanted to be a language teacher. But then I'm also Ghanaian, I'm West African, which means you have three professions. Doctor, lawyer, or engineer.
Okay.
And nothing else is really like the option that you could actually, you know, choose. And so it's always a joke between, you know, among West Africans, but, you know, it's really real. I was interested in adventure and travel. So I had started studying French in high school and then Spanish. And I was just really, really good. I'm always saddened by the fact that as an adult, I spoke fluent Spanish, but I've never spoken fluent Chui, which is my mother's mother tongue, which makes me really sad. But yeah, I spoke good French, but I spoke fluent Spanish. So then I was like, you know what? I want to take a trip by myself. I think I was about 17 and go check out Madrid. And my mother had a hernia and then a heart attack. but my dad thought it was a great idea. And so his thing was, I've got to organize your accommodation. So I was like, no problem. So I can go. So I literally... Then in Europe, you could get on a coach. I got on a bus and you can go through the Pyrenees Mountains into through Paris and then France and then into Spain and then onto Madrid. So that's where I went. I get off the coach, I get into the taxi, I have the address, the taxi driver takes me to what I think is a hotel. I come out of the hotel and the person walking towards me is a literal nut in a habit.
Go, Dad, go. He knew what was up.
So I said, so she's speaking to me, and you know, my Spanish was really good. And so I said to her, you know, where am I? And it was an actual convent. It was this place where all young teenage girls from all over Spain, when they came to Madrid, this was the place that they stayed. And I mean, when I tell you, it was like, you know, you're 9 p.m. curfew. Who leaves home to go on an adventure to have a 9 p.m. curfew?
Especially in Spain. That's where people are like eating their appetizers at 9 p.m.
Exactly. What was great about it was that it was Spanish all day, every day. You had to watch Spanish news and listen to Spanish radio all day, every day. Of course, we snuck out because I wanted to learn how to flamenco dance. Wrong part of the world, but I wanted to learn. That was ignorant speaking then. We wanted to go out clubbing, and we did. And just, you know, hang out, which we did, and had a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Flirted with some great Spanish guys, cute Spanish guys, and then lied to the nuns when we got back. And I have to say, the month that I was there, I never got caught. The other thing that I learned about Europe, though, was that European racism is a bitch. It's really hardcore. I remember walking, I was 17, and I'm 5'10" in my bare feet. So I remember walking into, it wasn't a McDonald's, but like a fast food joint. And I walk in and the place is just going silent. So I'm like, oh, wow, who's here? Like, who's here? So I'm turning around. And then I realize people are turning around and they're staring at me and the whole place goes silent. And it was the most bizarre, awkward, weird, terrifying thing. And I mean really being stared at as if you're a monkey in a zoo. That was the one time when I called home and I was in tears, said, you know, I want to come home. And my dad was like, welcome to the world. You gotta figure out a way, you know, to be. And so then I stayed in for a couple of days. I was like, I literally have a month. And then it was hard because then I was trying to explain racism to the Spanish girls. And they would just define it as, oh no, people are just curious. I was like 100 people in one restaurant. That's not curiosity. So it was a very, very particular experience. But so I went to Madrid. I would end up I lived in Las Canarias, the Canary Islands, in Ibiza, worked there in Tenerife for almost a couple of years. I detoured from languages and did not want to got into university. And then was like, yeah, I don't really want to go to university. I like this travel thing and I want to speak languages. So that is heresy in a West African household that you're not going to go and graduate from college.
Yeah.
So I ended up going to the Canary Islands and working as a tour rep, like a tourist representative.
Oh, yeah.
But then I started a newspaper when I was there. And would take stories from the different tour reps and so that's when I knew I was going to go back and do journalism. And so I lived there in Tenerife for a couple of years, again, because I spoke fluent Spanish. And then I had the opposite experience of racism. There was a really wonderful, you had to work with a particular hotel. And so I did. And there was this old codger. He could not keep any staff. So you've flown from the UK to work in these, you know, spots, and it's a highlight spot for British people, English people going on holiday because it's cheap. And this old codger had a very beautiful hotel. He could not keep any of his staff, and he would fire everybody. And so I was like, okay, I'll go. And so when I met him, I was like, oh, he reminds me of the elders in the African village. He's an ornery old guy. He has this beautiful hotel that's designed for English tourists, and he hates English people, like straight up hates them, hates everything about the English. And there's Ibiza, which is very touristy, and there's this part called Old Ibiza, which is very beautiful, and it's yachts and it's fishermen, but they're very moneyed families. So when I met him, I just never spoke to him in English. I always spoke to him in Spanish, and my Spanish was fluent. I always called him señor, as in sir, just thinking about how I treat the elders in an African village. Mm-hmm. And so I literally was his total favorite. And I had a wonderful time. I ended up meeting his family. Went out to the boat that they had, spent time with his sons and his grandsons, and just had a really, really wonderful time in one place in that space. But I'd started this newspaper when I was there. So when I came back, then I went back to school and I studied journalism. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And so you got a formal journalism degree and went out and pursued journalism. You worked for the BBC and reported for NPR, I believe, and, you know, all of these institutions. Will you tell us a little bit about your next transition from journalism? And specifically, I'm interested in hearing about your leap from pursuing a vocation as a journalist to your work in launching the ARMA Institute of Emotional Justice.
Yeah, so journalism is a love, is a first love for sure. And I love journalism and struggled with the environment in which I had to do journalism, especially in London. So I was a journalist in mainstream spaces. So those spaces are predominantly white and what they call rarefied air. So the BBC has a place called BBC Radio 4 that does beautiful documentaries, radio documentaries, where I worked for a good long while. But again, the navigating the kind of racism that you have to live with, but also it's how it shaped my sense of self, which is something that I write about with emotional justice, how it shapes my relationship to myself and how I define success became very tricky and very troubling for me. Because it was about how do you keep climbing a ladder when what it takes for you to climb is a negation of your cultural self. But nobody aspires to be a failure in any profession. So I didn't get the balance right. So I was teetering closer and closer towards just basically selling myself out. Selling out what I believed in, selling out the values that I knew, you know, were mine. And I couldn't figure out a way out. And so it made me resentful and bitter and angry. And this thing that I loved so much, I really started to hate. And at this point, I'd done radio, I'd done TV, I'd done writing, I'd won awards, all the stuff. And I just said, I this place cannot steal something that has brought me so much joy. But it really did bring me to the edge of being looking in a mirror and really saying, who are you becoming?
And really, so for you, can you take us back to the moment of discernment when you realized that it was too much, that it was asking too much to sacrifice yourself and your trueness of who you were? Right. That the equation was no longer healthy for you. What did that realization look like? How did you discern that? I'm sure you felt that over a period of time. And tell us about what it felt like to go, okay, enough is enough. And I have to kind of take the leap into something else because we've tipped, the balance has tipped too far in this direction.
So it was two moments. One moment, the BBC used to have a director general called Greg Dyke. And he was at a meeting and he ended up saying words to the effect of the BBC senior management is hideously white. And this became a national story all over the UK about how the BBC was just this very, very white institution, which it is, always has been, and continues to be. And I was working with a program called Panorama, which is a very, very high profile investigative documentary program with BBC television. And so, you know, I was, you know, it's as was often in those places, you're either the only black or one of two people of color. And so the senior management were doing this visit to just see what does that look like on the ground. And I remember being asked to make sure that I was sat in this particular spot and to basically be put on display. And it really reminded me of when I was 17 and in Madrid, and going through that space, and then all eyes are on you, and they're just staring like you're a person in a zoo. You just—it's just the dehumanization of it. So that was one point. And then the real breaking point was I was working on a documentary about a very high-profile killing of a child, and the those who were accused were also children. And I just got to this point where I almost sold out this group of young Black boys and their organization to get them on camera. And I mean, I caught myself just in time, but it really is a thing to bring, to come to the edge of what you believe and just say, I was about to put you on TV knowing that this environment was going to criminalize you, and knowing that it's not a thing that you can necessarily recover from because of how high profile this case is, because of how high profile this strand is, this show is, the millions of people that are going to watch it. And I'm going to have been the person that does that. So I had gone to the organizer and said, I really wouldn't put the boys on TV. They were pissed, quite rightly. They'd done a lot of work to get them on there. They saw it as an opportunity. I couldn't tell them the truth, which was that I'm really about to sell you out. I just had to say it's just going to be a bad look for the boys. He accepted it and they didn't, you know, go on. But for me, that was the end of my road in that space, for sure. Like I could not, I just had trouble facing myself in that moment and said, you got to go. This thing that you think you can navigate has brought you to your knees. You got to go. And I did. I left.
So will you tell us about the leap? What did that look like for you? What did leaving, did you know what the next thing was? Did you free fall for a while? Like, how did it feel and what did you do next?
So the thing that was interesting was I left London. I moved to New York. New York was a dream. I always wanted to be a journalist in New York. I had no idea what that would necessarily look like. I ended up having a phenomenal time, ended up hosting a morning show in New York. And then I was doing like MSNBC and CNN. And as a commentator, I started writing plays, got my plays produced and performed in New York and also in Chicago. So that was really wonderful.
Okay, I do just want to double tap really quick because you just so casually were like, I moved to New York and then I became an accomplished, published playwright. Will you, like, how did that happen? You're like, I don't know. I'm imagining you in your little New York studio writing plays. Like, how do you go from that to I'm seeing my work being produced?
So, like I said, I really always was a storyteller and definitely doing radio and doing radio documentary. Unknowingly, you're writing scripts all the time.
Yeah, sure.
I both loved it and was good at it in ways that I didn't even, you know, necessarily realize. And I hadn't built the institute yet, but I was always doing emotional justice work on the side. I had a production company that I ran alongside doing my journalism work. And I would do these dialogues and these discussions with, you know, wonderful scholars and activists and artists and, you know, authors. And so I had written a very, very bad book. Very bad, which I don't really like to talk about. Which we're not going to talk about.
The bummer thing about books is that you write them and then they're kind of out there in the world and doesn't matter if you change your mind on them.
I know, it's just really a bad book. I'd written a bad book, but I was in New York and they were like, well, you know, can you come? And then I was on the radio, so to come and promote the book. And, you know, with books, people do readings, right? And I was just like, I am not going to sit in front of people and read. Like, they could just read themselves. Why would I sit and read? The idea of it felt really weird. And I think it was going back to people just staring at you while you're doing something. And although I became a public person, it was actually very nerve-wracking for me to sit and read.
Yeah.
So I said, I'm going to dramatize an element of the book. It's New York. I'm going to get an actress. I lived in Brooklyn. I'm going to get an actress who... I'm going to dramatize this and she's going to do the dramatization. And then I'll just come along after her and then I'll just talk about the book. So this then became a wonderful success. And we kept getting invited to places.
Wow, cool.
Galleries. And so what happened is we ended up in NYU doing it was a dramatization and then a dialogue. That's how it was promoted. And it was NYU. So there was a bunch of theater people in the audience and they came down and one of them said to me, so how did you, said to the actress, the dramatization, you know, was amazing. And she turned around and said, oh no, she wrote it. I didn't do it. She hired me. We did some, we worked it out and did some direction. So he came up to me and he said, you know, this could be a one woman show. I said,
wow.
Well, absolutely. I said, well, I've never written. And he just said, I'll guide you. I'll show you.
So wow. I love that story. I'm so glad we double tapped into that, because I just love how kind of you came at it from such a different angle. It wasn't like I'm setting out to produce plays. It was, I wrote a book and then I'm kind of uncomfortable with what they're asking me to do. So I'm going to do a different creative expression that kind of morphed into a performance that led to, that's a very neat story of kind of an artistic evolution. Yeah.
And I really loved it. And just what I loved about it, you know, being a journalist, you write to deadline. There's a way that my brain works. And with plays, I just played. I just had fun.
Yeah.
I never really, I wasn't interested in, I wasn't going to become a playwright in terms of this is going to be my life's choice.
Yes.
But I loved writing the first one. And, you know, I ran a production company, so I'm big on, you know, marketing and publicity. So I was like, well, if I've written it, let's get it up there. And then I met a wonderful, because I was a radio host and I had created an art slot because I love art and I love theater and I love museums. We had an art slot on the air. So I was meeting producers and meeting folks all the time. And so they who'd come to some of the dramatization. And I said to one of the producers, oh, I've written this play. And they said, oh, we have a workshop series. A dramatized reading series. She should come and do the play. And then we just got such a big audience. They said, well, you should do it on your own. And that's how it started. And it was wonderful. The actress, Beverly Prentice Thomas, was wonderful in that first production. Mm. And then I wrote another one. Then I wrote another one. I think I wrote four in the end while I was in New York that were all produced and performed in New York and then also in Chicago. And I just I really loved it. It's never been, playwriting is really just creative confetti for me.
I think there's something so beautiful when either naturally or by force of circumstance, we separate ourselves from the thing that we're doing. Like we're not going about it saying, I am a playwright and that's who I am. And that's what I'm made to do. There's such a weightiness that comes with that. There's such a need to prove to yourself and to others. And there's a lot that gets caught up in that I think these moments in our story where we can say, I'm doing the thing because it's the thing that I want to create. I'm not even necessarily thinking what that says about me as a creator, that it's almost like we give the thing just freedom to exist.
Absolutely.
And to be what it's supposed to be and to not be so consumed with the outcome of the thing, because of course we believe that the outcome of the thing that we create is a statement about us as a creator, and instead say, I just want to get you out into the world. There's like a very beautiful freedom about that I hear in your story.
100%, Liz, really 100%. And because you let go of, like, I don't have issues about, is it good enough, perfection? I don't ever ask any of those questions, because I don't start off by saying, my approach is not that I'm a playwright. My approach is that I'm writing a play. And it has what I call, it has a natural end. And when it comes to the end, I let it go. And I have I don't have judgments about it or any of those things. Like, I've never thought, when people said to me, oh, you know, what about reviews? I genuinely thought, what about them? Because it just wasn't, that's not my profession. So I wasn't writing to get that kind of response. But then I learned how much the work landed and resonated. And we did the International Manhattan Festival in New York with my play, which was called Forgive Me. And, you know, they gave us a little black box theater because, you know, I'm a new playwright. Nobody knows me from a slice of bread. But I'm a hardcore marketer and I run a production company. So they call me 2 days after our tickets go on sale. And they say, wait a second, all your tickets have sold and you still have 2.5 weeks of promotion.
Wow.
And so then they say, we're going to move you to the main stage, which was so cool. So we had these wonderful, you know, moments that were just, you know, just really, really great. And I had a ball, but the place that I loved the most was when I was in Harlem, the Dwyer Cultural Center, a wonderful, wonderful man called Rosa Rivers, and New Heritage Theater, they really were the producers of all of my plays and just really supported me and championed me. And I just, and the beautiful full circle moment about that is that when I wrote my book 7, 8, 9 years later, when I went back to New York, the first place it launched, we did a dramatized reading back in the same theater where I did those plays. So yeah, it was a real freedom moment. Theater is a freedom space.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. Okay, so speaking of this book, will you tell us a little bit of a little bit of the behind the scenes of this process of bringing this book baby into the world? Was it easy? Was it simple? Was the path just very clear? Tell us about how you just wrote it and everybody loved it and it wasn't very hard at all.
Do we have wine? Can you get a glass?
You know?
I don't even drink wine. I need a rum cocktail. My book is called Emotional Justice, A Roadmap for Racial Healing. And really, it is getting it in the world was just a journey of rejection. It really was. It was so freaking hard. And, you know, the thing that I learned is, so one, that, you know, writing a book where I'm really bringing to life an idea that I have created based on my personal experience, my family experience, my journalistic experience. And so it's an idea that didn't exist until I wrote about it. So I'm not writing about a thing that's already there. You're creating something new. Sure. And I swear to God, it's this thing, like I'm a journalist, so I write. So why can't I write this freaking book? Mm. And then when I finally, got it down in a form, just this circle of rejection with publishers, just rejection after rejection after rejection after rejection. So honestly, I put the whole thing down. I just put it
you
down.
Did.
Yeah, and I said, maybe I'm just not supposed to write this book. Maybe I'm supposed to literally, I'm the CEO of this international institute that's doing this phenomenal work. That's, you know, what I'm supposed to do. But I had always said—
Okay, will you tell us, like, actually, practically, how long from the time that you had finished the proposal or the book and you were shopping it to publishers, if you had to guess, how long did it take before you got to the point where you were like, maybe I should just give up? And like, how many rejections do you think you faced in that season?
Oh, well, I mean, I first started writing it. It's probably been 10 years because when I first started writing it, nobody was talking about issues of racial healing. And I didn't have a strong enough writer's footprint for anybody to really take it seriously. But I was I was shopping a proposal then and working with some wonderful people, but I could not, this is going to sound weird, the thing that I had created, I couldn't communicate it on the page so that you could understand.
Oh, wow. What I was saying.
It was such a...
So it wasn't just external resistance were facing. There was some internal,
really,
like, I have this thing, I have an idea, I have a vision, and I can't communicate it in a way. Wow. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's
so it was inside,
gutting.
Yeah. As I call it, it was inside outside fuckery of a, you know, global proportion. So I literally started, working on the book in New York and then finished it in Ghana, in Accra. It was easily 10 to 12 years.
Oh my gosh, Esther, that's a long time.
Oh yeah, because when I started working on the book, I was still figuring out what the actual roadmap was. So if you're trying to build the thing and then write about the thing that you're trying to build. So what I learned is, you know, you pick it up and you put it down, or then I would have an agent and the agent wanted it to go in this direction because they wanted something that felt more familiar. But I was building something and I knew I was trying to take it somewhere. But the agent didn't necessarily get that. So that couldn't work with that agent. Then I would put it down for a while and I would pick it up. So there was that starting and stopping for really, really a long time. So then.
And as you're just constantly getting rejected, it's just like, no for this, no for that. What is the story that you start telling yourself? Like, where do you go mentally and emotionally as you're just like, facing closed door, closed door, closed door?
Yeah. So I had a mix. I closed doors and doors were closed on me. The point at which the doors are being closed on you, one after the other, after the other, after the other. I just gone inside of my own head and it's like, I'm not supposed to write. And then it's like, do I know how to write? Like, do I really know how to write? Should I be writing this? You know, the publishing world and the writing world are two different spaces. And what I learned is if you get into the business of it before you've really done the creative of it, it's, for me anyway, it becomes a mess because you're trying to literally create something. And unlike playwriting, I won't lie, writing my book was not fun. I would not say writing my book was fun. Now, I'm really, really proud of the book that I wrote. And I love the book that I wrote. But the process of writing it was a lot of headaches. Like, I, you know, really, when I say it was, the experience of dealing with the world of publishing was utter pissosity. It really was. And then, you know, just the rejections. I remember putting the book down. I have a wonderful village of great, you know, women friends. I called everybody. I just said, that's it. I'm not writing this book. I'm putting it down. And they were like, what? But to be fair, one of them just said, okay. And the thing that I learned is this work that really is purpose and mission and vocation, it keeps bubbling up. So even when I put it down, then I would leave it alone. I would be out meditating, walking, doing whatever I would do. And then the ideas would start to come and I would come back to it again. Then, but my final journey, when I finally found the publisher that would publish the book and the editor, was absolutely wonderful. I had a wonderful editor called Steve Piacenti, who was just an absolute champion for the work. But by the time I got to him, I really had figured my shit out. Like, I'd really figured it out. I was in a very, very different place. But it was a hard, hard journey. I don't know how people say they write books and it was easy, because it definitely wasn't my experience.
I love, so it's interesting to me because you kind of, it was like, okay, I can't figure out what I'm saying and then I can figure it out, but now nobody else is going to listen to it and doors are closing.
Right.
And so there's this moment where you set it down and you decide maybe I'm not a good writer. Maybe I shouldn't be doing this. And I love that there wasn't necessarily like a dramatic moment where it came back, where it was like, you know, someone knocking on your door and like, oh, your manuscript had gotten lost in the mail and now we had found it. Some like big drama. It's just in the still, small, quiet moments that you created, to be fair, there was just this still, small voice that was like, I'm still here. The idea, the thing that needed to come into the world. And so it was less about some big call or big reveal and more about you just actually listening to that whisper that said, like, you think you're done with me, but I'm still here.
Absolutely.
And just listening to that voice.
Absolutely. 100% correct. And now I've learned, in leading the Institute, that quietness is the place where all the best ideas come, the work emerges, the ideas emerge, what the project should be. It's all there. And I'm, you know, writing on I'm writing a second book now as well. And the process is very different because of what I went through the first time. And mostly what it means, what I learned is that I just have to be more patient with myself. Because when I write a play, it's a very free form experience. You know, like I don't, you know, there are people who study writing plays. We'll talk about form and all of these different things. I don't know any of those rules because I never studied it. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's a real free form experience. When I write a play, literally an idea emerges, a title emerges, a character emerges, a scenario emerges, and I just start writing and I just keep going. And then it starts to form itself. It really is free form. And so there's no pressure or anything to it. Writing a book, whole different animal. Like you can't not have some kind of structure. But I don't, my trying to apply a journalistic structure to the book didn't work. Trying to do it from a playwright's place, it didn't work. So what I had to learn is it's its own thing. You have to honor what it is. But I had to learn that. Trial and error. A lot more error than trial, I have to say. But we got there in the end.
I was just talking to a friend recently who is an entrepreneur. And he's kind of thinking through this idea that he might have to kind of, in his words, start over. Like the thing that I've created doesn't seem like it's working. And his experience being like, I find myself just like going to God being like, I can't do it again. Don't ask me to do it again. Just start up, starting from scratch, pushing the boulder up the hill, just the sense of I can't do it again. And one of his trusted friends said to him, well, who is the me? Him saying, don't make me do it again. Who is the me? And who is the it? And he was like, well, I am the me, and it is starting another venture, like starting another organization. Mm-hmm. And his friend was like, yeah, but you're not you that you were when you started 5 years ago. Like the you, that's not you. You're not you anymore. You have 5 years of lived experience and you've changed and you've grown. You're not the me. And it isn't that it. It's going to be something entirely different. And that just like really stuck with me of this idea of when we do something a second time, so often I feel like it feels like, oh my gosh, the blank page. I went through this whole thing to bring this book into the world and now it's like I'm back at the beginning. But the reality is you're not, because you're not who you were when you started out the first time. And the thing that you're being called to bring into the universe isn't the same thing, and it's going to be a different journey. And I just thought that perspective was like, that it was so refreshing, like this idea of like there isn't ever really such a thing as starting over. Mm-hmm. There's only a different song and a different dance that's available to us in a different season.
I really, really love that. And I actually think that the narrative of starting over is the internal insecurity that is voicing itself to interrupt your natural process. And that part of the work is to not allow it, you know, to do that. Because you're 100% right. I love what you said. You're really not starting over. Like when I started writing the second book, it's a totally different experience than the first. Because what I understand is that just writing the book is just a different framework. It's a different muscle. It's a different discipline. It's its own creative lane than my other stuff. What I've also learned is I write creatively whilst I'm writing the book, because it allows me to always feel a sense of freedom and accomplishment when I'm struggling with doing the book. Now, what will or will not happen to the creative writing, that's whatever, screenplay, play, I have no idea. I'm not really thinking about that. It's just a process to enable me to get, you know, to do two things at once and know that I'm disciplined enough that I'm going to get to the end, because I know that that's been part of my journey. So,
I love that. I love that. Well, thank you so much for sharing your beautiful story. Outside of buying your book, wherever books are available, how this can folks right learn? What'd you say?
I said, this book right here.
Oh, yeah. How can folks learn more about the work that you're doing at the ARMA Institute of Emotional Justice, and how can we get involved?
So the best way is to go check out the website, theaiej.com. theaiej.com, and everything you need to know is there. We do a wonderful monthly newsletter, and you subscribe to that and you get monthly information and updates. But we welcome you into the world of emotional justice. It's a racial healing roadmap, and we create these wonderful innovative racial healing resources through projects and training and thought leadership, and you can both get engaged and involved and learn more about it through all of that. But got to start with the book, though.
I got to start with the book. Do your homework. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for just the work that you're bringing into the world. Thank you for turning a lot of really painful experiences into purpose and meaning and impact, and helping to co-create a tomorrow that's a little bit more just and equal and bright. We're super grateful for you and the work that you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to this show. This has been fun, a great conversation. Let's do it with some alcohol next time, because, you know. A cocktail makes every story a little bit sweeter. But this was fun.
I love it. I am very pro that. We'll publish this episode at around 5 p.m. Right. So everybody, even though we didn't have a little cocktail to join us, we can encourage folks on the outset of listening that they'll at least be armed with a little. I think you said your drink of choice is rum. So we'll honor you with that. Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Esther.
Thank you, Liz. This was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for being here and for listening to this episode. For updates and announcements about the show, you can also visit lizbohannon.co or follow us on Instagram. I'm at Liz Bohannon, and I love to hear from my pluckies. So until next time, stay plucky.